back to Classic Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, we have Oren Fader. That's right, more Manhattan School of Music here on today's Classical Guitar Insider. That was two intros for one, I feel like. Oren Fader was a very sweet guy, super surprised to just see him. You'll see how shocked I am by his youthfulness. He really does look younger, and he explains why. He gives us a couple of reasons that we can speculate on. I got to be honest with you. I am not going to make much sense this morning. It's Saturday morning. It's September 13th. This is going to be released next Friday, but next Friday I am recording. Finally, the recording will actually occur. I just have to have complete faith that everybody will do what they say they're going to do. I'm nervous about the traffic. And it's a Friday night traffic. People are going to have to go to Scarsdale, New York for it. And there's one guy in particular, and some of you know the guy I'm talking about, that is just, oh man, I'm so scared of him being late. And then he's got to be late. I got a guy leaving at 5 o'clock to San Francisco, so he's going to be raring to get out of there early. And the recording is now starting at 5:30. It was starting at 7, but I was like, look, I can't do that to you. I can't have this guy sitting there hating every moment of the recording because, I know that he's got to go to San Francisco. And then, there are people that are just finishing teaching at 4, so I'm real nervous about it. And I got to relax. So in order to relax, I went out last night. And, this is actually the first intro that I've done for you guys where I'm a little hungover. some respiratory issues, I feel like. It's not that easy to talk today. So you'll forgive me if this intro sounds a little, sweaty. I almost feel like I need to open a window or something. I thought I could do this no problem. I don't know whether I'm going to open the window or turn on the AC. I think I'm going to turn on the AC. You guys are cool, right? All right, so we're going to have a little bit of air conditioning in this. Sorry, Oren, that this happens on your episode. It's no reflection of how I feel about you. And I hope to see that guy again soon. But yeah, no, it's September again. So, everybody's in a good mood because it's, you can dress like men again and go outside in pants instead of looking like a tourist in the 80s. I look terrible in shorts, I think. I look like Humpty Dumpty. I have great legs. I've got these beautiful, CoverGirl gams with some hair on them. And then I've got this Humpty Dumpty top. So I look like Humpty Dumpty in shorts, I think. I don't, at least that's the way I feel. I don't feel comfortable in t-shirts and shorts. T-shirts show off my womanly figure. Anyway, so of course, I'm ready to go out. I go out last night. You can probably hear it in my voice. It's a little raspy. It's not because I smoke, because I don't. It's because, I have to yell, and the bars were loud last night. People were excited. I was out in Brooklyn with a little Mickey Shitpants, my friend. His name's Mike. And I was out with him, and we were dealing it. We were doling it out. We were talking about our problems. And for some reason, that dumb DJ just came on, and DJs these days are just dirtbags. The guys that show up at the bar. I mean, this happens all over the United States. So you know what I'm talking about, wherever you live. I'm sure it happens in Europe, too, for those European listeners. I'm not too sure whether it happens in Iran or Korea, where I have like 3 listeners. Anyway, so the DJ just pops up and just, all of a sudden, he has to be super loud while he mixes, I don't know, Tupac with someone else. I don't even know. I don't care. It's such a stupid skill. I know that there's a lot of people that think that they're real musicians, and I think they are real musicians when they need to be or when they want to be. I'm not saying that the real guys, the real DJs out there aren't real musicians. I'm just saying there's nothing worse than these amateur, iPad DJs that come into bars and just grab a stool. There's not even a booth anymore. All they have to do is grab a stool, plug their iPad in to the speaker system and turn up the volume. That's not being a DJ. You should have your own equipment. You should have some pride. You should have your own speakers. I'm not like the biggest vinyl guy in the world. I kind of think it's a racket, but You know, you should have vinyl. You should have to haul that shit in crates like they did in the old days. Instead, this guy just comes up, destroys our conversation, creates the raspy voice that you're hearing right here because I'm now having to scream over this guy. We went to another bar. It wasn't that much better. But it is good to be wearing pants again. That's what I'm saying. It's good to have my pants back on and feel like a real dude. You know, hiding a little bit, wearing some button downs so that you can't see everything. It's just the weather is just, it's magnificent right now. They keep on saying it's going to rain, and it doesn't. And it's still sunny. So it's got that crisp. I don't know. It's nice. I'm loving it. And when it does rain, it rains a little. September weather, man. It's just, it's the best. The only thing that ruins it is the fact that we have to start teaching again. Am I right, ladies? Right? Back to school. Back to school for Bonzo. Big diaper Brett's gone back to school. School starts next week. And that's the other reason I'm doing this. So this next week is going to be hell. So I decided to do all the editing on my Saturday for you guys. So I hope you appreciate this podcast because I'm just giving up a Saturday to edit it. I can think of 1,000 things I'd rather. No, I'm just joking. There's nowhere else I'd rather be than in the loving arms of my audience, of all 6 of you. Anyway, so, back to school. All right, so here we go. You guys ready for this? Yet another year of the same stuff? Why is it the same? Because I have beginners again. You know? I know I complain about it. Every year I can, well, you know, this is the third year. Third year of the podcast? What are we talking? We're approaching. Well, I guess the podcast probably came out. That's not even 2 years old. I feel like I've been doing this for longer. But I certainly feel like I've been teaching for long. But now it's like I'm starting to get to that point where this is probably where I'm going to end up. I'm just a little too good at teaching. I don't think I am. I think that there are people that are better than me. I've seen what a great teacher is like. I have a boss who I think is a great teacher. One of the greats. A person who is really there for the children specifically, and music is simply and this is not to discount him as a musician, he's an incredible musician, but when he's dealing with the children or the parents, when a good teacher is dealing with children and parents, it's really the priority is always the child, and then the music is second, whereas I have a hard time reconciling that. I have a hard time saying that, you know, it's okay for a kid to cancel his lesson because he's got a play date. And play dates are important to the child's development. You know, I have a hard time with that. It's just not me. It's not my racket. It's not why I got into this. I got in this to perform and to teach music to people that wanted to do it. You know, I'm still not there. I'm still not there. Well, certainly performance-wise, we're lagging a little bit here. We're getting back on the horse, though. Like I said, I promise this recording is at least going to be a good recording. I hope. If somebody can just remember to bring all his microphones and get in the car at the right time and not stop for gas or not get stranded on the side of the road or all these other things that seem to befall only him. If this person can get there, this recording will be good. As far as the teaching is concerned, yeah, I'm still kind of in this thing where I'm good at teaching beginners and I'm good with the kids, and I'm getting more work because of it. I broke my rule this week, the rule that I told you about, which is you don't teach before 3. I'm now one day a week starting to teach at 12:45, and you know, I started it last week. I started at that school last week, starting the 12:45. The money was just too good, and it was an opportunity to coach a chamber group of high school students, flute and guitar, for 2 hours. And I was just like, "All right, that sounds good. You know, I can do that. That sounds like fun. That sounds like right. I mean, am I right? That sounds cool. Like, if it was just like, hey, we've got a." We got 6 more 8-year-olds for you to teach today. We need you to come in at 12:30. I don't think I would have done it for any amount of money. But this to me had a little bit of you know, the idea of coaching a chamber ensemble is stuff that I've done with the guitar ensemble where I teach now. But at this new school, you know, dealing with high schoolers and stuff like that, I think it's going to be fun. So I wanted to do it. So I'm doing it. And it actually worked out fine. You know what? Little Wendy might come through the door at any point. So, you know, you'll forgive me if I hear noises and react to them. Anyway, and also the hangover isn't helping me with the hearing things in my head. There are voices in my head today, folks. Anyway, so I'm doing it. And I did it last week and it wasn't that bad. I just had to get up like an adult. I had to get up at like 7:30 or 8 and get the practice in. And then also, but now it's like, this is going to double up. So I'm going to do this. And then I've got like 4 more hours of teaching after. Oh God. And teaching, for those of you who aren't guitar teachers, it's not like regular work. And I know that sitting at a desk and you know, and just doing task after task after task, or if you're assigned a project, it's probably similar to that. But it's kind of nonstop work, and there is a performance aspect to it where you've got to keep the student or students engaged, and on, and you have to be on. You can't phone it in. I mean, there are those teachers that just give out assignments and then sit at their desk probably on their iPhones the entire time. But that's not, I don't have that luxury. We're actually not allowed to use iPhones while we're teaching, which is a rule I wholeheartedly agree with. But anyway, so yeah, I don't know. I don't know about this year. I don't know what's going on. I lost a couple of students that I really enjoyed. They got too busy. Another one of them, you know, went to college, so that's sort of sad. But I don't know. I've got a mixed feelings about this year. In a good way, because I mean, last year when I talked to you guys at this time, it wasn't. I was not 100% into it. I wasn't feeling it. I really wasn't feeling it last year. And then last year ended up kind of turning out pretty good, where I felt like I was getting a little more respect and notoriety as a teacher. I heard about you, and you know, we really want our kid to study with you, not just to take guitar lessons and checking my availability, and I'm just sort of interchangeable with other people. So it was good. It feels good, but at the same time, the question remains, is this what I want to do with my life? Do I want to just teach children for the rest of my life? And also, you know, I'm still young enough, and I'm a younger looking guy. I think I look a little younger than I am, to where, you know, I look like a teacher. I look like a guitar teacher. But, you know, if I start getting that old, you know, I don't know, old timer music teacher thing going on with the bags under the eyes and the exhausted look because you did a recording session last night till 2:30 in the morning, I don't know. I don't know if I want to be that guy. Also, I'm a heavier guy. So I would be like a heavier, tired, exhausted teacher person. And I just don't know if that's what I want to do. I don't know if that's best for the kids. You know, it works now. I got a round face. Kids love this round face. Kids talk to me at diners all the time. I'd just be sitting there and a kid will go, hi, because I have a Charlie Brown head. It's got to be the head. I've got a large head that doesn't fit into a lot of hats. And I think that's why the children... you know, just enjoy, whatever, looking at this giant face. Anyway, so we'll see. Let's get to the, let's get on. I'm excited about this year. Actually, I'm excited that the recording's coming out. I'm actually a little bit excited about my students. I like this schedule. The schedule doesn't go as late. It starts a little earlier. Actually, I'm starting at 2:30, I should say, on the other day. So I'm completely breaking my rule. But I'm doing it for good students. I'm not doing it for just for work. And it's a reasonable commute. It's, you know, it's right across the park. Yeah, I don't leave the city to teach either. That's another rule. All right, no reverse commuting. It's bad for the city. let's get on to our sponsors. You know Savage Classical. Savage Classical Guitar. That's wrong. SavageClassical.com. Let's go ahead and see what's going on over there with old Rich. I got to have him on the show. I think he's nervous about coming on the show. Savage Classical. I don't know why I feel like this is the way. No, come on now. What is my problem? See, this is what I'm talking about. Savage. Also, I can't spell. You know, just be honest there. I don't know what happened. If I was dropped on my head as a child or something. But there are certain basic skills that I lack. Yeah, look at this. You guys know who Michael Battelle is? Powerful, refined sound. 2014 double spruce with Macassar ebony. What's Macassar ebony? That sounds nice. Does he mean Madagascar ebony? No, I don't think so. Bob Desmond. Select German spruce and double side old growth. Man, dude. Old growth. Should we be cutting down old growth? I don't know why I'm sitting here. Okay. You know what? For a guitar, yeah. For a housing development, no. Yeah, guitars should come from nice trees. These guitars are beautiful. Look at this Gonzales. Look at that rosette. Man, you know what? I really got to get there. The amount of guitars that this guy has is pretty mind-blowing. I've never seen anything like it. SavageClassical.com, I am proud to say, sponsors this show, and I wish you would go there. Talk to Richard. He'll set you up with the guitar of your dreams. Go to NewYorkClassicalGuitarStudio.com. NewYorkClassicalGuitarStudio.com. You go there. You sign up for the Oktoberfest. The Oktoberfest, these four guitarists are going to help you with your technique, your sight reading, your musicianship, ensemble technique, practice skills. The thing is, you got to know how to read music. That's the caveat on here. All right, so if you don't know how to read music, maybe you should start there. But if you do know how to read music, you can sign up for Guitar Fest. And these are four of the best and brightest guitarists. Three of them are the young guys. Ben Verdi is there. Ben Verdi, if you don't know who he is, he's the head of the guitar department at Yale. Then you've got Simon Powis, Colin Davin, and Gohar Vardanyan. All right, those are three of the young guns that should be world famous already. They're three of the best guitarists in the world, and just because they're young doesn't mean you shouldn't have the utmost respect for them. All right? So show some respect for them. Show some respect for this show. Show some respect for me and show some respect for yourself by signing up for Oktoberfest. No, sorry, Guitoberfest, not Oktoberfest. That's what I'll be at. So if you want to see me, just go to any German bar this month, next month. But anyway, you got to sign up now. The next five people that sign up will get a gift bag full of goodies from Diodario valued at $200. All right, registration, you just got to submit a recording. All right, recordings, you got to have a recording equipment. Just record into your iPhone. iPhones sound better than a lot of the other crap out there. All right, anyway, let's get back to the show. Here's my interview with Mr. Oren Fader. I mean, you seem like a very young guy. Oren Fader has been around forever in my little life, and yet you seem like you're my age. If you don't
I'll
mind me asking.
I'll be 48 in November.
Okay, so yeah, I'm 37. Why do you look so young? What is that about? What's going on there? You understand that you look like you are 32 years old.
Yeah, that's nice of you. And I'm wearing a CBGB's t-shirt.
You are wearing a CBGB's t-shirt. Which actually ages people nowadays because it's been gone for 10 years.
That's right. Back in the 70s, yeah, I saw the Ramones.
This was where all the kids hang out, right? Yes.
That's funny.
Go ahead.
Yeah, when I heard about CBGB's, it was being sold. And then the guy was going out of business.
The guy was
going
to move it to Las Vegas. Did you hear that?
Right.
He was going to rip everything out and then put it together piece by piece in Las Vegas like an Irish pub does.
Right, stone by stone. And that didn't happen?
I don't think so.
No, of course not.
That is the grossest idea I've ever heard. That's like the last thing that anything of any integrity goes through is like digging itself up and moving itself to Vegas.
To Vegas, yeah.
Which I've never been. Have you ever been to Vegas?
Sure.
Oh, you have? Do you like it?
Yeah, no.
No, I don't.
No, I don't. But it was really, I did a gig there, and it was really fun, and we stayed in a hotel.
Well, if you go to UNLV or something, that's got to be cool.
Right, a colleague of mine teaches flute there. She loves it.
Right.
She goes hiking, you know. That's
Ricardo Cobo's there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Who used to live right across from me.
Yep.
I remember taking a few lessons with him. He lived right across the street on 43rd. Good coffee. You like coffee? He was into coffee.
Yep. He sure was. He took coffee. I saw him. He drank it on stage sometimes.
Yeah, very seriously. That's good.
It's insane. That's all in a cup of coffee. It's like, long flight.
Yeah, so maybe that's what keeps me looking young, the good coffee.
Oh, so you do drink coffee?
I do. But just a little bit.
Not today. Only.
But I, you know, I've been a vegetarian for 30 years.
Okay, there you go.
And I do Tai Chi.
There you go, too.
I'm going to say I don't exactly live stress-free. I have stress.
Yeah.
But I was going to say maybe not that much. Feels like a lot to me, but maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that you feel stress. I mean, you seem to be a pretty busy guy. Even for 48, you have quite a expansive career. So, I mean, as far as like, well, I mean, we could talk about Ricardo for a second. I mean, how did you know, like him in New York? I remember he was in Texas telling me this was 15 years ago that when he was here, that it was very difficult for him to kind of find a place that all the little holes for teaching and stuff were filled.
It was hard then, and it's hard now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's Ricardo Cobo.
And that's a genius, unreal, wonderful guitar player.
Yeah, if anybody should have been able to kind of squeeze in here,
yeah,
without going to college here, it should have been him.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
And you. Yeah. Well, I mean, the only reason I have any kind of job, like my Manhattan School job, is just because I was going to school in Florida State as a grad student, and my teacher, David Starobin, called me up and he said, do you want a job at Manhattan School? And I said, yes.
Now, he was your teacher for undergraduate?
Correct, at SUNY Purchase, State University of New York Purchase, which was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
I mean, studying with him we can talk about that now or later. It was amazing.
Yeah, we can talk about that now.
But I mean, okay. But I was just going to say, as far as the job goes, I mean, when I hear about students who graduate and now trying to find jobs,
mm-hmm.
Well, also, I heard that interview and Ben Verdi was talking about the need for a doctorate. I mean,
God,
getting a doctorate frightens me. I can't even imagine it. It's, you know, it's a horrible idea.
Horrible.
I can't even.
A couple of years ago, you need it now.
You need it. And then there's no guarantees. It's tough.
And then there's no guarantees.
Yeah, anyway.
But luckily, they're starting to make these diagnoses. You know what I've found from talking to people, talking to people like Ben, is that these doctorates actually, they make them semi-affordable. It seems like they're almost more affordable than the masters, definitely the undergraduates.
That's good.
Which is kind of, or they make them, you know, like at Yale, it's free or whatever. So hopefully we're kind of moving towards that kind of a model where there's a donation system.
Yes.
And there's a network of financiers that will finance these doctoral students.
Because
it's just... To go to another 4 years of college and to pay that amount of money at the kinds of schools that are going to make you competitive, Yale, stuff like that, Julia, it does have to be. It has to be cheap or free because you're already in the hole.
Or huge scholarships available.
Right.
I don't know what school gives out those huge scholarships, but yes, they have to be that.
When you went to Florida, did you pay a lot?
No. I did really well at Purchase and Florida. I got a scholarship, and then there was some kind of, can't remember it now, some award, big stipend. I just wrote a letter saying I was this amazing player and was doing all these wonderful things, which wasn't that true, but that really helped me go to Florida State. I mean, already it was a lot cheaper than going to a private school because it was a state school. I was out of state, but I did fine. Somehow I got a lot of credit card debt, though. I'm trying to remember.
Did you buy a guitar?
No. No, I bought my Humphrey in 87 or 88. It's from 86. So blissfully, I haven't had to buy a good instrument for years and years and years. And that was before Tom was really famous. So that was like my teacher at that time, David Starobin, said, you should buy this guitar. And I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And it was like $2,500 or something ridiculous like that.
Oh, my God.
And so that guitar has aged really well. It's beautiful.
That's amazing because within 6 or 7 years, that guitar became a...
Right.
I remember it was the first guitar that I saw when I was young that was like a $6,000 or $8,000 guitar, which back then, those guitars are now $12,000 to $15,000.
Yeah.
Is kind of where we're floating around.
Exactly.
In the 90s, it was $6,000 to $8,000.
Exactly right.
The coolest guitar in the world. The Humphrey. Millennium.
That's right. The Millennium.
And is that what you didn't have a Millennium?
Cause it was
it's a Millennium.
Yeah.
And did you have a relationship with Tom Humphrey?
Well, You know, Tom, I grew up on the Upper West Side.
We've actually never talked about him on this show.
Oh, really?
No, I don't think we've ever gone into the Humphrey.
Well, I mean, I can talk just a little bit about him. I mean, he was the nicest, kindest, most wonderfulest man that I have known.
Well, that's good, because that's not what I've heard from everybody.
Oh, well, fuck them.
Fuck them. There you go.
You can bleep that out. No, I mean, Tom.
He was nice and kind and wonderful?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, he would call me up.
Yeah.
And he would say, the Assads are in my living room. You need to come now.
Oh, cool.
And then I would come.
And this is when he lived in the city?
Yeah, he lived on 72nd Street.
90, 91, something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he had his workshop there. This was before he had his workshop in the 20s, in 29th or whatever.
Mm-hmm. When I got here, he was already gone.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was upstate, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, he would just call me and say, there are all these wonderful players in my house. Come. Come now.
Everybody
Vladimir Mikulka's playing in my... in my living room, come. So I'd say, okay. I was kind of shy. I mean, I didn't. But I came.
Just like you're shy and you came to be on the show today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all good.
It's amazing how many people played his guitars.
Oh, yeah. And also Bruce. So there was that relationship with Bruce Holtzman, who was my second wonderful guitar teacher.
Right.
And Tom tried to get me for years to go study with Bruce. And he said, oh, you need to study with Bruce. Bruce is the best. And I kept thinking, like, I was a New Yorker and a snob. I thought, what in the world am I going to do in Tallahassee, Florida? There's nothing going on. There's no work. There's no opportunity. At least not for what I did, which is freelancy stuff. And
but
he kept bugging me about it.
Yeah.
And then sort of planted the seed. And then... you know, I had heard a lot about Bruce and his wonderful ears, and how Tom would always say to me, that guy can teach a chair to play. He can teach a chair to play. And I said, okay, that's good, you know. You know, there's some things I still wanted to work on, you know. And so then I thought about it, and then I met with Bruce, and I said, at Tom's house, because they were very, very good friends.
Yeah.
And I said, Bruce, you know, I want to learn this, this, and this, and can you help me with that? It was technical stuff. And Bruce said, yeah, I can help you, but there's no pill. And I really respected that.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I will come to Florida. You tell me what I'm going to do, and I will do exactly what you say. And I get annoyed when my own students don't do that with me. I'm not saying I'm Bruce.
Yeah.
But, like, you go to someone to study, and you don't fight them. You just do what they say. You have to trust them. Otherwise, why bother, you know?
Yeah.
So, and it was funny because my first roommate in Florida didn't do that. And I'm not talking about Steve Walter. Steve, in case you're ever hearing this, wasn't you?
It's not Steve.
No, Steve. Love Steve. Steve Walter was my roommate for many years at Florida. Uh-huh. And he's a wonderful builder and wonderful player. It was nice to geek out to. But anyway, it's not good to name names. But you got to go to someone and trust them.
Yeah.
And try what they say.
Yeah.
And anyway,
are you a hard ass teacher a little bit?
Am I what?
Are you kind of a hard ass when you teach?
No.
Because I mean, Bruce, let's face it, he is. I was an Adam student, and Adam was a hard ass.
Yeah.
And he got it from Bruce.
Yeah.
So you know, it's
Bruce said I taught my brother. Yeah.
I mean, I think they are the sweetest guys in the world, but I think they are also hard on their, they're hard, they're not sweet to their students.
Yeah,
they don't pull punches is what I'm trying
to say. Yes, I didn't feel that from Bruce. Bruce never told me I sucked or anything, or, you know, there's lots of famous stories about you, tone sucks. I didn't get any of that.
Yeah.
No, Bruce was always very kind, and he would say, sounds good.
Maybe
and
you even were prepared.
Even when it wasn't good, though, yeah. I knew later, I didn't know, I thought about that teaching. I was with him for 3 years. And again, I was right about Tallahassee. Nothing going on in Tallahassee. So you just practiced.
Yeah.
And I did Tai Chi there too. But I thought, why did he tell me I sounded good when I was really sounding kind of crappy? And I thought he knew that if I did exactly what he said, that I would sound good. And I did. I didn't sound good when I was there.
You didn't?
No, because I was trying new things and
oh, that's
you know,
interesting.
And I
so you didn't sound good when you were studying with him.
Well,
not that good.
You know,
I had a very similar experience. I hate to kind of always in. I hate that I'm interjecting so much with Adam and Bruce, but there was a very parallel thing that happened to me, which is when I was in Texas, there was so much new stuff happening, and there were so many players, and there was so much activity.
Yeah.
And there were so many people going off to competitions that I was kind of a nervous wreck coming out of there, and my junior recital I felt was just, you know, I didn't like it at all. I felt bad about it. Senior recital was, you know, okay. But it wasn't until I got out of there and just sort of was able to be in New York with Fred, who's nice, always nice, and always warm, and always, you know, a positive reinforcement, and sort of getting that. And then, like, but the guy who I always go back to is Adam. Like, he's in my head all the time. Still, at 37 years old, I still, while I'm practicing, I'm like, You know, resolve the dissonance to the consonants. You know, just things that he said that are constantly in me.
Yes.
But at that time, it just kind of made me nervous because I was trying to put all the pieces together.
Sure.
So I mean, it sounds like you had a similar experience.
I did, in that you study with a great teacher and you hear some stuff and then you hear some stuff later.
Yeah, it takes a while.
Sometimes some stuff takes a while and.
To digest,
Years. Or maybe you weren't ready for it, or
yeah, you got to mature into the role.
You mature sometimes, and I just love that. I respect that so much. Teachers who see the immediate and then see what you should be doing in 5 years, and maybe they tell you something and you don't quite get it, but you try, right? We agree, you need to try.
But
then maybe you didn't quite get it, but then after a process and you digest, you come to New York, or you stop comparing yourself to everybody else in the conservatory who are all amazing.
Right.
You can relax a little bit, and then, that it speaks to you, even 5 years later, even 10 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, boy. But you know, it's funny, we were talking about how hard it is and how hard it is to pay for school.
Yeah.
But it is so important to go to a school and study with someone that you love and you trust. And, it makes it, you know.
I think a lot of people don't.
What were you going to say? I was going to say the other stuff can be valuable as well. You know, your history courses and your solfège courses. I remember all that stuff. But I mean, your private lessons, for especially for a guitar player. I mean, that's just the reason you exist every week, is to go to your lesson. And
no, those students that want to constantly have a reason explain to them for every movement that the teacher makes.
I don't like it.
I don't like it either. I didn't like it when I was there, and I certainly don't like it as a teacher now. But I don't really have any college. I have like one kind of, you know, college-y kind of kid.
Yeah.
Competitive guitarist. But other than that, nobody.
Yeah.
But I'm more speaking as a student. I was like, why are you... You have to do everything he says.
Yeah.
Like, it's like this is that moment. This is 4 years in your life, which is just a fly on. I don't know how you say it. What do you say? A flash in the pan. A flash in the pan when it comes to your life.
Yes.
It's not that much time just to sit down and let somebody else take the wheel for a while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
To guide you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, if you just relax and let them do it, kids out there, just.
These young whippersnappers.
Just do it, you know? Like, you're not that smart.
Sometimes, I don't want to sound like a curmudgeonly old man, but I sometimes see the same thing in master classes, either that I do or that others do. And, the guy or the woman who's teaching that class, they're just trying to help you.
Yeah.
And you should try it.
Yeah. Stop with the eye rolling and the okay.
It's good to try.
Yeah.
I remember David Leisner gave a wonderful class at Manhattan School many years ago. I'm going to say like 15 years ago that I remembered.
Sure.
And he wanted someone to do while they're playing some hard passage.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of goofy and embarrassing, but it was really helpful. And the person was resistant. But the whole class could see that if this person did that, it was really helping.
Yeah.
And I think the person felt kind of silly and exposed, but it was very helpful. We could all see it.
Yeah.
We could all see it. So, you know, you have to make yourself. Look.
That's part of being an art student in general is vulnerability.
Yeah, that's what it is, vulnerability. Yeah. That's hard. You know, we all don't want to do that. But in your private lesson, again, if you trust the person, then you just put yourself in their hands, and then you take what you can.
And just be glad you're not a singer, because they do all sorts of ridiculous things with their bodies and mouths.
Funny you say that. It's funny you say that, because, well, there may be all more drama with singers in general.
Yeah.
My wife's a singer, but she may say the same thing about singers as well, so it's probably okay.
But your wife's a mezzo.
She's a mezzo, which that's is, right. Which the is, lower the tone,
the more, the bigger the brain.
The more grounded, yeah. That's harsh.
I like mezzos. I do. Yeah, I mean, I dated a mezzo for 5 years in college, and nice. Yeah, they're just very. I don't know. To me, they have to play boys sometimes, so it's sort of
that's
like
that's right, a pants roll.
Yeah,
my wife told me about pants rolls. I never knew about it. Hansel and Gretel.
Hansel and Gretel, Orfeo and Eurydice.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to play with mezzos.
So they're kind of they don't have that same sort of a diva. Sort of
it's
mentality.
Hard to play with divas.
Yeah.
And guitarists are so not like that.
Yeah.
You know, my experience in school, both grad and undergrad, were that all the guitarists would hang out and have parties together and talk and chat and geek out, and it was all fun and not competitive. And singers were not always that way. What was scary to me is in undergrad is many singers would leave their lessons in tears, you know, just miserable.
Yeah,
I think it probably got a little personal, or maybe that's just the nature of teaching voice. It gets, you know.
They do, yeah. No, it's voice and violin.
Intimate.
Gets. Yeah. They seem to not really. The master classes that I've seen, those two instruments in particular, they seem to really lay in easily really be. Is that? What do you mean by wow? Am I?
No, I'm just. Going? I'm just. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's kind of true.
I'm remembering
this one master
singers
yeah.
in tears. Just.
We're not trying to, you know, tear the paint off the walls, darling. Like stuff like that in a master class in front of 100 people.
Oof.
Oh. So anyway, yeah.
No.
So.
No.
It was, anyway, so yeah, that's the thing is we kind you as a teacher you have to balance that, but at the same time, like you seem like a pretty relaxed. Relaxed guy.
Yeah, I'm pretty relaxed. I love freelancing. The stressful part is learning so much new music in a short time and then not ever playing it again.
So let's talk about the freelancing thing, because I haven't had that many freelancers. In other words, like
yes,
almost a studio musician.
Except there's not that much studio work. I wish I was a studio musician.
But explain your role as a freelancer, how that came about. Because you said that when you were going to Bruce, you were like, I'm kind of trying to freelance. You're kind of trying to be a jack of all trades or what?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of what you have.
Yeah, that's what I do now. So
not to say that you're a jack of all trades. You're very good at what you do. You're a very good classical guitarist. Very, you know, competitive on that level. But I'm talking about just sort of.
Yeah.
A lot of people have that goal. A lot of listeners have that goal, I think. A lot of young people have the goal of, okay, I'll do this classical guitar thing. I'll go through the work. I'll get really good with my right hand. And then I'm going to go back and I'm going to start that band I've always wanted to start.
Oh, well, that's nice too.
Right.
More power to you if
or
you're
just
successful.
To diversify.
Yeah.
To go into like a Holzman program, to go into something, you know, like that, which is just geared towards churning out competition winners. I can understand your trepidation with doing that, but I guess we should rewind and go back to how the studio work began when you were doing undergraduate work in Purchase. Or
well, it wasn't.
How old were you when you were going to Purchase?
Yeah, I was 18. I think was I 18.
Oh, so you were right. This you're just normal.
At a high school.
Where are you from?
New York City.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
in New York.
I grew up in Ben's building.
Well, the name Oren Fader is Turkish?
No, Israeli.
Israeli, okay.
Oren is like Jeff in Hebrew. It's a
common
name. Okay.
Yeah. Oren.
And Fader is just pops. Yeah. Russian, Polish Jews. That's my dad's side. My mom was born in Jerusalem.
Fader's an awesome name, dude.
Yeah, you like it?
Yeah, it sounds like laser.
Darth Fader.
Did you get called that a lot?
Yes.
Open up. It's okay. He's crying, everybody. Go ahead.
Yes, you know, that's the worst thing, right?
No,
the pummeling.
Oh no.
No, no, no. It's all fine. Public schools.
Cool.
But
which one?
This is PS75.
There you go, baby.
Right on Upper West Side.
Yeah.
And Joan of Arc, which is 92nd Street, and then Bronx Science.
Oh, you went to Bronx Science?
I didn't want to go to Bronx Science. My parents forced me to Bronx Science, which is kind of weird because they both went to Juilliard, and my dad's a viola player who plays in the City Ballet for 40 years. So I think they were really nervous I wouldn't be able to make a living. But the only reason I got into freelancing is because of my teacher, David Starobin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could talk the whole podcast about him. What an amazing teacher and influence and also professional mentor he was. So he got me my first gig I ever had, which was playing, I had to buy shoes for that gig, was playing a solo piece by a wonderful composer, Mark Antonio Consoli, New York, Italian-American composer. Really nice piece, and I had to sing a little bit too in the piece. You know, you sang did variations on it. Boy, that was hard.
No.
But anyway...
that's like the brrr thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right, exactly.
When you see that in the score.
You just got to do it, which is funny because I'm in a group with, so many things to talk about. The freelance biz was through David Starobin, and it was a gig, and I could do it, and I did it, and it was great. And, I mean, it's been a long time. It's probably been 20 years of doing this. And the freelance biz in New York is a wonderful way to make a living. I mean, there's so much. Now, I don't play electric guitar on Nashville guys do on pop records. I don't do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the electric guitar stuff I play is classical music for electric guitar, of which there is a lot. There's tons.
Wow.
Of I mean, if you were a composer writing nowadays, you would probably write for electric guitar because that's what you grew up with, you know?
Yep.
Many composers, even if they're not guitarists, like that's what they know. And so there's a ton of work for electric guitar in orchestras and in chamber groups. And then there's a ton of work for classical guitar in chamber groups and orchestras and smaller groups. And then I'm in six different groups where I do that stuff.
Yeah.
That are
six.
Yeah, that are groups that I belong to. And then there's just freelance stuff.
Yeah.
That I just get a call. Because if you're in this town for a long, long time and you can play, then you will get calls.
Well, and you're also, like you said, you're being, but you do limit the electric guitar playing to composed classical music.
Yes. Right.
When I say classical, just, you know...
notated. I say it's notated music because...
Yeah, that's what I meant. In other words, there's no like improv.
I'm a bad jazz player, but I studied it for years and years and years. You know, the side-by-side.
I assumed that you were probably a great jazz player.
No, I'm a really bad jazz player, and I would never do a jazz gig. I mean, I could read a chart, so I could accompany a singer who wants to sing, like, some Jobim tunes or something.
Right.
But I'm just a bad improviser, bad jazz player, You know, I can fake it, but not well. That's just not what
I do. I fake it. I'm like, well, you know, you got a 50-50 chance of the note being right.
That's a good point. You're one fret away, right?
You're one fret away. So just that's dia, you know, just do it. Yeah. Just bend it.
Bend to the note. Yes. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. No, blissfully, I don't have to do that. And I remember struggling with that. It was in college. I thought, can I do both these things? And I realized I wasn't that good.
Yeah.
And I was a good classical player. And I understood it, and I liked it. And I remember having some kind of thing with the elitism or the snobbery of classical music, which is total
bullshit.
Nonsense, yeah. But at the time, I was concerned about that. I thought, my brain was a little wrapped up with classical music.
My experience with the pop people or the sort of Broadway...
Hmm?
You know, those guys to me sort of have a lot more attitude than any string quartet you're ever going to meet.
That's funny. Well,
there's a lot more like, this is the way things are done.
I see. You know? Maybe so.
Cue me in.
I see.
You know, stuff like that. Do I have to cue everything? Yes, that's the way it's done.
That's funny.
I don't think that's the way it's done,
pal.
That's
funny.
But yeah, so that's you funny. Were saying the classical.
Well, I just had to get over that and focus a little bit. But you know, like even as a classical, even if you don't play electric guitar, I mean, you can play Dowland and then you can play Carter.
Right.
And those things are so incredibly different. I mean, the only thing you're doing is playing them on a nylon six string. But I mean, they're worlds apart, aren't they? In every single way. And your training has to be broad for you to play Dowland and Carter.
Yeah.
And anyway, so David Sarabin, thank you. I got a lot of amazing training.
Let's talk about
training,
David Sarabin.
Training. It was the training. Like, you were saying you remember things that Adam told you from years and years ago.
Yeah.
I remember, I play music sometimes, and I remember.
What years were you with him?
Yeah, 4 years in college.
What, do you remember what, like?
Probably 88 to 92.
Okay.
I think that's what it was.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, that would have been like the peak of his career. Like, he was playing a lot, he was making a lot of decisions.
Mother, yeah, I remember.
He was the guy.
It was just amazing to watch, very intense. And
I can't believe his output.
It's incredible.
I've never seen it. I don't think, other than like the big three, there's no catalog like that.
It's incredible.
An amazing amount of music.
And also all the producing stuff he does, guitar and non-guitar stuff, is incredible. It's incredible.
I don't like using the word genius, but it seems like... And when I spoke to him, I mean, he is... I mean, studying with him had to be... I mean, because had to be a little bit of a challenge, because he is sort of his own person. Like, he's not necessarily the most normal of dudes. Like, he's in his own world. You know what I mean? In a good way.
I
enjoyed speaking to him a lot, but it was like he's it's I take back my normal statement. He's totally normal. The thing about him is that sort of threw me off a little bit is how incredibly serious he is.
Yeah.
But then once you get talking to him,
it
becomes charming because it's a world of so much depth.
Yeah. It's what
and
he,
knowledge.
It's what he loves.
And he loves it so passionately that that's what you're seeing. So I can imagine that when people meet him for the first time, they're probably a little bit like, boy, this guy's sort of doing his... He's not necessarily. He's just... he really takes this very, very, very seriously.
Yes, totally. Totally true. So, yes, I remember I would want to play some rep, and David would say, what are you playing that for? It's nonsense.
Nonsense.
Yes, he did say stuff like that. But
you were just whipped your entire way through college. You just didn't have
a single
breath.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. May I have another? No, but what I remember mostly from those lessons were with standard rep and early rep and contemporary rep, it was the music. Like, what's going on here? What did the composer want? What's the intention? How are you going to make this work? You know? And I remember with Britain and Hinastera, those two pieces, like, just never forgot it. I mean, believe me, I could tell you the details of those analysis of those two pieces in those lessons, the Nocturnal and the Sonata, Hinastera Sonata, and Carter.
When you analyzed it, were you just talking about more harmonic analysis?
Yeah, exactly. And phrasing and articulation and all those things. And so I remember a lot of those details. I really do.
Yeah.
But even more than that, I remember the approach to music. And that has helped me so much because I get scores, either solo or chamber scores, and I think, the fuck is going on? How am I going to make sense of this? If it's a wonderful piece, it's a little easier to tell what's going on.
Yeah.
And if it's notated well, it's a little easier. But maybe it's not that great, or it's not that idiomatic, or it's not that clear. And then I think, oh my God, how am I going to make this music?
Yeah.
How am I going to make this convincing? I have to play it in 2 weeks. I have to make it sound like
you have to make it
like
your Mahler. Your piece of shit.
Gotta make it. harsh, dude.
It's a piece of shit, but make it your piece of shit.
I have to make it convincing.
Right.
And my colleague in one of my groups, Cygnus Ensemble, which I have for over 20 years with my colleague, Bill Anderson, the fiddle player from that group, Cal, said the most valuable thing we can be teaching students right now is to look at a piece of music, and then in 10 minutes, can they make it sound like music instead of nonsense? And that is a hard thing to do. It's anyway, David Sarabin helped me immensely with that through the analysis and through making sense of music and
making sense, right? Making not just playing it.
No, right. No, playing it, but
I hear that a lot in new music too. I hear a lot of players that just play it, and it's like it's not going to play itself like Bach does.
You have to find
each motive. A lot of new music is motive based. Absolutely. You know what I mean? And finding that and exploiting that.
Got to make sense of
that's the art of it.
Got to make sense of it.
Yeah. So that was that was one of his big contributions to you.
I mean, he taught me how to play too, but aside from
that. He taught you technically how to play.
He taught me everything. But aside from all that stuff, even if we had just done that kind of analysis on guitar, you know, Jews on Passover, they say Dayenu, you know that?
No, I don't know.
Means that would have been enough, you know.
Dayenu.
Dayenu, yeah. So even if he would have just shown me the musical stuff, that would have been enough. He taught me how to play too, but aside from that.
Was he a passionate teacher?
Yes.
I imagine.
You said it. Yeah. Very intense, you know.
Yeah. Very intense.
But
when he's there, when he's in that mode, that's when he shines as a human, as a person.
Yeah.
Not when he's doing niceties. Not when he's like saying hello, goodbye, you want some coffee. Stuff like that doesn't necessarily. It's more like when he's talking about music that you're just like, this guy, I could talk to this guy forever.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's the love and the intensity. But, you know, I don't want to make this all about David, but
no,
he did get me a lot of work, too. That's the thing, you know. It's so important to have someone help you.
To have a champion.
Have a champion into the world of the freelance biz, you know?
And Manhattan. And Manhattan School.
And Manhattan School got me a job. That's huge. That's huge. And
he didn't get you the apartment, did he?
No, my mother forced me to do that. Yeah, you know, my Jewish mother was always worried about how
does he dress you? Living. Did he pick out your shirt this morning?
No, my wife did that. Oh, I told you, man. I'm wearing a CBGB shirt.
That's right.
There's nothing
coolest.
Fancy about
it's
it.
Coolest.
You know?
I love it.
No.
but the thing is, so that's David Sarabin.
Yeah, my teachers were wonderful. They were so wonderful.
Who did you have before him?
Another wonderful teacher. I got to tell you, I was lucky, man.
You should.
In public school. PS75 on the Upper West Side.
Yeah.
We would go like once a week, once a month to Bloomingdale House of Music, which is a little community music school. It's still there, 108th.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go there and play percussion instruments and recorders, you know, and it was great.
Yeah.
And then when I was about 9, studied guitar there, you know, like group guitar, folk music. And then I really liked it. And then I studied with a guy who taught there named Jeff Israel. You know Jeff?
Oh, it sounds very familiar.
Okay.
I'm an Upper West Side teacher.
Okay, so he taught there
yeah.
for years, and then I studied with him, and then he said, you know, you should just study with me privately. And then I did at his studio on 76th Street.
Yeah.
And that was years and years. And what was so amazing about Jeff is we would do rock and jazz 1 week, and then classical and finger picking 1 week.
Exactly.
We would
alternate. That's exactly
weeks.
What you got to do with kids, I feel like.
It was just the most wonderful. So we would learn like the Bach Beret, and then the next week we would learn Allman Brothers tunes.
Yeah.
And then we would learn, you know, on the classical thing, we'd learn classical gas.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And then the rock and jazz week, we would learn The Girl from Ipanema.
You got to do that. You got to do that with the kids because it's just like
wonderful.
They are. What makes such a good thing about this instrument is being able to go to summer camp
oh.
and play Pink Floyd
My
with your
God.
Counselor.
Exactly.
You know? And if you can't do that, and you're just like, well,
especially with the guitar. Right. I mean, in my whole history, I've only had one student who like didn't know how to play Beatles tunes. Yeah. Just knew how to read music,
yeah.
Just sheet music, and
it's not fair to them.
No, yeah. And with the guitar, there's just something. And now I have to say, I'm sorry, Jessica, to my wife. Like, I buy a lot of electric guitars because unlike my Humphrey, they're really cheap, and I can do that.
Yeah, you can get for $2,000. You can get like the best electric guitar.
$2,500. Are you kidding? So that's just such a joy, because just to play an E chord on all the different electric guitars is such a joy, and they all sound a little different. And my Humphrey, if I'm playing well, sounds great, and if I'm not playing it well, sounds okay. But with these electric guitars, like, you just plug into my old bar mitzvah amp, and then you play a chord, and it's so great and delicious.
Yeah.
I just love that so much. So, it's important. It's important.
It is important.
I have nothing against guitar competitions. I have nothing against...
Did you ever do them?
You know, I did one.
Me too. One.
I did one. I did Toronto when I was young.
Oh, the real... Oh, the
and I was is 19 that even still or around? Something. I don't know. And I didn't win, and I realized a lot of the players had so much more technique than I did, and I was kind of a little traumatized. Yeah. I was disheartened. And I thought, forget this, I'm never doing this again. And I never did. And maybe that was stupid. I have nothing against competitions. It's wonderful, the preparation that you do for a competition. I think that's very valuable. The tricky thing for me is conservatory students who are spending 6 months learning a Bach suite.
Yeah.
You know, in the real life, you will never, ever, have that kind of time to do anything.
Right.
So... You know, it's a joy to focus that way, and it's good to learn a Bach suite. But the time, you know, it's you need to be a really good reader, so it doesn't take you 6 months to learn the thing.
Right.
I think conservatories are very valuable. I'm not saying we should get rid of them, but the reading is so important. Being able to read, being able to play electric guitar nowadays is so important. There's Manhattan School students who like, one of my old students is Taylor Levine, who's in Dither, you know that group?
Yeah.
And, like, I didn't teach him any electric, but he graduated and he found work as an electric guitar player. That's what he does now. And wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, great.
I agree.
I think that's totally wonderful.
Yeah.
Electric guitar is so important. I mean, at least you need to be able to play and know what distortion is and effects. And just because there's so much music being written for that. And, you know, if you only want to play old music, that's fine. But, I mean, you have to be David Russell then. You know, you have to be David Russell. Because, does anyone really want to hear you play...
Bach kind of well?
Bach, or even very well. I mean, when there's...
No, even when I hear people in restaurants playing it really, really well every once in a while in New York.
I respect that. It's wonderful, but, like... Can you make a living doing it? You know, you have to be so great to be able to do that. You know, so just above and beyond.
Well, I was just talking with my bassist. Yeah, that's his bass back there. I was talking with him.
Oh, an acoustic bassist.
Yeah, I have an ensemble that plays up. I'm doing that. I'm writing all the music. We have an ensemble, clarinet, violin, me.
Wonderful.
I'm like a little Oren Fader. But the thing is that I'm a little Oren Fader that looks 5 years older than Oren.
You do look very young.
Well, we're both young. New York keeps you young, baby.
And we don't smoke.
And we don't have kids.
Okay. And we don't have kids. Maybe that's it.
I think that's it.
Maybe.
I think that's a little bit of a secret. My friends with kids are gray, and they are big.
It's tough.
It's tough, yeah.
It's tough, yeah.
They come around. I think they're going to win in the end. But yeah, so he was just talking about how he wishes that he was like, yeah, I kind of wish I went, because he was a Juilliard guy, and we were hanging out after rehearsal yesterday, and he was like, I kind of wish I went to Berkeley. And I said, he goes, you know, I wonder if they offer like an online class or anything. I was like, you know, I understand. He goes, he's like, because all I really learned was, because he plays, you know, jazz now, but he's like, all I, you know, if you go to the conservatories, you just, the most you're going to learn is like bebop. And it's like, you know, into like the pop world. They're not, you can't really get a taste for how.
You mean as a jazz major or just as a classical bassist?
Even as a jazz major.
I see, right.
Even if you go to New School Berkeley.
It's, or Manhattan it's, School now has a great jazz program.
Right.
But I see, you would learn traditional.
Right.
Yes.
So he was he was talking about like he wanted to learn like recording techniques.
Yes.
How do you just, you know, record on one of these little, one of these things? You know, like
what you do.
How about a class? You know what I mean? Yes. I still struggle with this stupid thing.
This is very, very valuable.
How do you just make a demo? How do you, you know, how do you, who do you, who do you go to? What what organizations are the most important organizations for you to target when you get out of school? If you're in chamber music, it's CMA. If you're a soloist, should you do APAP? Is it for you? Because they have Chinese acrobats that you're going to be in competition with.
That's
so
right.
Is that what you want to do?
That's funny.
All that
you
kind
say
of stuff.
That.
Those kinds of discussions don't take place in the system.
Yeah. It's, I agree.
And neither does electric guitar.
Right. Right.
A lot of the time.
Well, I feel like that's, that should be your teacher's encouragement. If they don't play electric guitar, that's fine. I'm not saying your conservatory teacher needs to be an electric player.
Yeah.
But to encourage that is very important.
Teacher has the pressure, though, too. The teacher has the pressure of, like, this guy, I'm supposed to get this kid recital ready.
That's right.
By June.
That's right. He has to play Targa in 4 years. Well,
he's got
totally,
a concerto competition coming up.
I agree. Can't do everything. But a little versatility, a little career thing, the CMA thing, a little reading, learning to play in chamber groups, the recording thing, that's so important.
How do you address reading
with students? You need to do it.
Okay, you do it.
You just do it.
How would you suggest, because this is, reading is the final frontier for us. It is something that we generally can't do. I mean, you can do it, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But
I'm a good reader. That's why I work.
That's why you work.
That's most of the reason.
That's the reason why I don't work. That's the reason why I have to like create these weird little situations for myself
creative,
to sell.
Which is good.
It's very creative, but it is also, it would be super nice to be able to just like say, like if someone said, hey, Brett, do you want to come and play The Lion King tomorrow?
Yes.
I would say, I can't do it.
Scary.
I'd say I can do it in a week.
Yeah.
But give me a week.
Well, a week is not bad. Come on.
Well, a week for The Lion King. I think I could pull it off. I'm saying, but to be
generally,
able to read like that is just so amazing to me.
This, especially for new music.
Yeah.
And some old music, too.
Yeah.
And how do you do it? You do it, if you're disciplined, you just practice it. You just read stuff.
Do you have students that read, that can't read, and then when they're done with you, they can read?
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
I didn't mean to, like, bum
you
out.
No. No, that's okay. But you know, I don't have that many classical legit students.
Oh, okay.
So I haven't had that experience. But I will say, if you're not disciplined enough to just read a little bit every day, it doesn't have to be classical guitar music, it can be anything, the way to do it is to do a lot of wedding gigs and other gigs where you are forced to learn quickly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the real world, no one wants to rehearse for a wedding gig. The flute player, for instance, that's going to play with you on that gig, like, they would never rehearse. The money's not good enough, and, like, are they going to rehearse Pachelbel's Canon? You know,
and they can do it.
And they can do it. Right. They can do it. So
I stopped taking wedding gigs because it took, you know, a couple hours a week to keep that stuff up.
It's a drag.
Yeah.
So if you take the gigs, then you're forced to learn to read, or at least to have a book that you know you can fake through.
Yeah.
That's important. And you get good at it if you freelance, because you're forced to.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So that's how you do it.
That's how I did it. Yeah, you take the work. I mean, I wasn't incredibly disciplined as far as reading goes.
At the beginning, did you have a lot of failure experiences that you needed to just be like, okay, well, I'm learning? Or
no, because I didn't have that much work.
Right.
Matter of fact, I remember there was time between undergrad and grad when I would literally wait for the phone to ring. Like, I lived in Astoria, and I go out for breakfast, have a little coffee, and then go home, and I would just wait.
Practice and wait.
Phone, I didn't practice that much. Uh-huh. The phone never rang. You know, it just, there was nothing going on. Uh-huh. You know, one gig a month or something, it's not enough to sustain you. Then after years and years and years, you do it, and then you learn, you see patterns and you, oh, here's the thing. You play lots of chamber music.
Yeah.
That helps you read.
Yeah, because it scares you into reading.
Scares you into reading, and your partner will not have patience if you suck. So the chamber thing is so important. And at Manhattan School, when I coach ensembles with guitar and another instrument, the guitar is always the weak one with the reading. Always.
Always.
It's just the way it is. And better now, but still, and I see guitarists go, meaning they make errors, and I can see them in their practice room making the error and being like, okay, let me fix that. Because that's the way we are. Like, you're in a room by yourself, make an error, and you're like, okay, I can fix that.
That's what we're trained, what we're supposed to do.
It's just what happens by ourselves.
So you're saying don't do that, just play from A to Z?
Well,
if you want to learn how to read.
If you want to learn how to read, exactly. Exactly right. You keep going. And when you play a lot of chamber music, either just reading with a friend or date a flute player, that's good too. Mm-hmm. And then you are forced to do that because your partner won't have any patience with you, stopping all the time.
Yeah.
And that is helpful and doesn't require any discipline on your part because, I mean, look, if you are disciplined and you want to practice reading for 30 minutes a day, I respect that. I really do. I never did that, but it's a wonderful thing to do. But the chamber thing will force a guitarist to do that, and that's helpful.
Oh, yeah. No, and they really don't want you to stop, which is something...
You can't stop. No, you can't stop.
With this group, not with this group, but with groups before,
yeah.
Different iterations, that was a big thing that I learned. I was like, okay, stop. So we're just going to work on the first, you know, six lines, if you guys are cool with that. And they'd be like... Yeah, sure, that's fine. And I'd be like, okay, so like, let's bring it out here, you know, like really getting into the, like doing a running a David Starobin on them, you know, for the first six lines.
Yeah.
And they weren't into that. Yes. They were into like playing the whole thing, going like, okay, let's go over two measures for 2 seconds.
That we need to
And then
to
we're
do.
On to the next piece.
Absolutely.
Don't bore me with the details, Brett.
You said it.
And so, yeah, that's the thing, their amount of patience. Which
but
is,
if you still have this group, it must mean you got over it.
Oh, I got over
it. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, we're playing the whole thing, and then I, you know.
Well, this is the proof. You just proved in real life what I'm saying.
Well, I'm playing with the group, but I'm not sight reading with the group.
Oh, there you
go. I'm just beating the shit out of myself till I'm where they are on day one.
Beautiful. Do what you got to do.
Right, do what you got to do.
It's the fear. That's good.
It really is the fear, and it really is like the embarrassment.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't want to be embarrassed.
You don't want, as my friend Barry says, my flute player I play a lot with, he always says, don't look stupid. You know, you don't want to look stupid. So you gotta
you
do what you gotta do.
First of all, you got a flute player named Barry who talks like this.
Well, Long Island, but you know, he doesn't talk like that so much.
I've never met a flute player that that is like that.
But you know, that was Long Island. It morphed with Bruce.
Don't be stupid.
Morphed twiddle, twiddle, Bruce. Twiddle. But you know, now that I'm making fun of that accent, I'm sorry, all the Long Islanders and Queens.
No.
But
it's a horrible accent. They know
don't
it
talk
too.
Like that. Don't fucking talk like that. But I remember Bruce when we're talking about fear.
Yeah.
And I said, Bruce, you know, it takes me 3 hours before I feel like I'm really feels good and I'm ready to really play well.
Yeah.
And he said, well, then you better warm up for 3 hours. Like, if that's what it takes, if you gotta cram and read to feel comfortable with these accomplished chamber musicians, then you do that. Wonderful.
Right.
You know, but you'd never do it sitting alone in your room.
No, you won't do it with the and with the practicing thing. Okay, well, any sort of like specialized practicing regimen is always going to take the back seat when something comes up. It's just the first thing to go.
That's why you got to do it.
That's why you got to do it for real.
For real when you're in school. Right. Yes, yes.
So as far as like the, I'm going to practice sight reading for 30 minutes a day, I don't buy it. Like you're saying, I mean, if you have work.
If you can do it, again, I want to meet that person.
How do you feel about your classical playing? Do you feel like you were really, really good? Kind of a weird question to ask.
But
it seems like you don't feel like you were.
Oh, I see what you're asking.
You know what I mean? 100%.
I always feel like my classical playing could be improved.
Yeah.
Like, I would still like to take lessons, and I should take lessons, but I don't. But I should. I mean, like when we started this interview, we were talking about Rick Kobo. Like, Rick Kobo was across the street from me. So I thought, okay, this guy lives 100 feet from me. I should take a few lessons with him. You know,
the answer
he studied with Shearer and Bruce.
Yeah,
I should take some lessons with this guy. I had no excuse.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I did take a few lessons.
Oh,
wonderful.
Did.
Yes, yeah. I did. I really did. But then, you know, like to go back to Bruce in Tallahassee was complicated. You know, like I think one time after I graduated, I went there for a Tai Chi event in Tallahassee. And then I had a few lessons with Bruce, and that was so wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, to...
Go back home.
But you know, here's another thing Bruce told me, which really shocked me. When I got the Manhattan School job, and I don't mean it was just me, it was four faculty. It wasn't just me, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I had a couple of students. It's not like, that job is not like a real job, it, you know, when someone teaches at the University of South Carolina or something where they have 20 students and they're teaching freshman music theory and they get health and pension or whatever. It's not that job.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, and we have such wonderful players, wonderful faculty, but it's not enough to make a living by any stretch of the imagination. But like everyone said, oh my God, wonderful job in New York, and Bruce was like, well, okay, meaning like I took that to mean, well, you still should study with me for another 3 years. You need that training. And all things being equal, he was probably right. I could have done another 3 years of very intense, obsessive,
yeah,
you know, shape your nails the right way training, but I couldn't give it up, you know, because New York is my home, and I love freelancing, and I love new music,
yeah,
and I like doing that. So I made the right decision, but like, yes, you can always get... Here's the thing. I play the Aranjuez Concerto once a year.
Yeah.
And it always makes me very nervous.
Yeah.
And I know if I was a great classical player and I played the Aranjuez 20 times a year, it would be like, oh, I'm playing the Aranjuez again. It's never like that. It's always like, oh, shit.
I know.
I have to play that piece. It's really hard.
That just doesn't turn off unless you're doing it every week. Unless you get a concert a week, that does not, that button doesn't
turn
off.
I always feel like for the great classical players, when that's all they do, maybe it's easier for them. I imagine. Maybe it isn't.
I played one concert with the ensemble in May, and it was like, the presenter was like, so, you know, she's young, mm-hmm. kind of a fun girl. And she goes, so you guys nervous? And I go, yeah, I'm totally nervous. And everybody else was like, no. Like, they're like, no, we're okay. I was like, you guys aren't... Wait, nobody here is nervous at all. Not at all. And I'm sitting there going like... You know?
Well, you're so honest. And I listened to the podcast that you did with Ben.
Yeah.
And one of the things you both agreed on that struck a thing with me, just like you're saying, is when you play two concerts a year, or your freshman... I mean... That's two times. That should be your two run-throughs at someone's house till you're ready to do your real run-through in your folks' place. I mean, you need to do this again and again and again and again.
Yeah.
Like all the bands you love and admire, like they play their set list
every night
for 10 years.
And that's why they can do it and hop around and sweat and yell.
I mean,
and
it must be
pee
so
on their
much
guitars.
Fun to do that. What a joy,
what
you know.
What a joy.
What a joy. And like in the new music world, that never, ever happens.
Right.
In the groups I play with, sometimes, like, I have this amazing new group called Vox and Plux.
Yes.
So that's me playing classical guitar and sometimes electric, a little mandolin too. And then my colleague Bill Anderson, who's actually a very good mandolin player and a good guitar player. So he plays mandolin guitar, and now he bought a theorbo, so he's playing a little theorbo too.
Oh, dude.
I don't know, that's crazy. And then we have this wonderful singer named Elizabeth Farnham. So it's Vox and Plux, meaning voice plus the pluckery.
Uh-huh.
And when people write new music for us, we do play it more than once just because we can't stand to only play it once.
Yeah.
And we don't have that big a repertoire, so we have to play it and repeat a time. But that is such a joy to play a new music piece five times. Six times.
That's what I was saying about new music. It's always
Frank Zappa said
every
that.
Time I hear it.
He said the premiere is the last.
And
time.
I'm like, and it doesn't sound. It's like that's.
No.
It's not really given its fair shot.
It's not given a fair shot.
When you hear like Glenn Gould play Schoenberg, it's like it's beautiful because he has spent 6 months on it.
How about playing Goldberg Variations for 30 years?
Right.
Absolutely.
Two recordings over the span of 20 years.
Was it 20? Yes. I mean, that's such
50 something to 82.
You have to do that. And yeah. And the composers who get their, who get people to do multiple performances, they're so lucky. I'm not saying, well, they should be happy. I'm saying they're the lucky ones to have these repeated performances because, like you say, it can't be like the premiere.
They have to play. I mean,
you've got to do that.
I'm not even like it. It's like that's the thing. It's like for me, the music that we're playing is so challenging that like there's a CD release coming out probably in November or something. Cool. I don't know. I'm like sitting there and I'm like, I know what it's gonna sound like. Like it's gonna sound like I'm nervous and I'm gonna blow a couple of passages and it's like. But that's going to be the one that I invite all my friends to and everybody. And,
ain't you know, that the way?
Yeah. And then
make sure you put me on the mailing list.
Oh, okay. You're good.
Put me on the mailing list.
I hope you like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Put me on the mailing
list. Well, I don't have a mailing list, but I will. I'll just tell everybody.
Really?
I'll tell everybody.
That's one thing we were talking about when we need to tell our students.
Is get on a mailing list?
No. Is to have a mailing list.
Not get on a mailing list.
Well, get on a mailing list is a thing you tell your colleagues. Yeah, it's a nice thing. Like, I will come to your gigs.
Oh, that'd be so much
fun. You know what I mean? Like, if you don't come to people's gigs, why in the world would they come
to
your
gigs? Do
you
hear that, everybody? You know? We got a teacher at Manhattan School of Music. Someone who already has a career. Already has all his, you know, the ducks are in order for Oren.
I'm so busy.
He's so busy. You're successful. And then you're like, hey, tell me, I'll come to your gig. That's not normal.
I'm good about that. All modesty aside, I do come to my colleagues' gigs, people I like, like guitarists.
I
come to their gigs, but I also come to new music gigs because they're interesting and they're my friends and colleagues. And it's important to go.
Yeah,
and also new music gigs are like $10, so I can do it.
That's true.
So yes, I don't often go see the Cleveland Orchestra at Carnegie, although I do that once a year. But mostly I go to new music gigs and colleagues. Well, usually they blend because like.
Dude, I gotta go see Cleveland at Carnegie. I've never seen Cleveland. They are, in many people's opinion, the best orchestra in the United States. Right?
Wonderful.
Cleveland.
I don't know. I missed that gig when I played it. I was hearing someone play at Spectrum probably for $10. But
well, so is there anything that you want to plug? Is there anything that you want to? I mean, you already talked about your Vox and Plux.
Yes.
Is that sort of that's the one of the seven pillars of your performance schedule?
There are groups I play with regularly.
Yeah.
And I love all of them. They're all on my website, which is orinfader.com.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're the ones that I play regularly with. So of course I play with my wife. She's a wonderful mezzo. Mm-hmm. That's the Bowers Fader duo because she's Jessica Bowers. Yeah. We have a lot of YouTube clips. So that's a duo.
And mezzo and guitars again.
It's wonderful.
Not to pump mezzos too much, but it's a really good combo.
To all you guitarists, I found these wonderful, wonderful Mozart transcriptions and Brahms transcriptions. These are all through my students at Manhattan School. They brought in a Brahms song. I thought, oh no, it's wonderful. Like this stuff sounds like it was written for guitar. It's wonderful.
Wow.
So, thank you, students, chamber students at Manhattan School.
Yeah.
But then there's my group Cygnus, which is a new music group, a sextet with Bill Anderson, wonderful. There's Vox and Plux, which is me, Bill, and Elizabeth, two guitars or whatever, and soprano. Then there's Poetica Musica, a wonderful group I've been playing with for many, many years. That's with Barry, the flute player. Ellie Valkenberg is soprano and other folks. And we tour around a lot. We've been all over the world in exotic places and Jordan. Actually, we're supposed to go to Israel this year and then got complicated. And so.
So you're going to Jordan?
We went to Jordan 2 years ago. And we thought we were going to go to Israel this year. And then for obvious reasons, because they're at war, it got complicated.
Yeah.
But Poetica Musica is a wonderful group. I've been playing a lot with the Talay Ensemble. I'm just a freelancer with them. I'm not in that group.
Yeah, because that's big.
But that's a wonderful group. They work a lot, and I play electric guitar with them.
Are they? I'm sorry. Are they? They're at Symphony Space. Is that where they usually?
They play all over.
Symphony Space is going under.
It is.
I think it's going down. I think it's going down. I'm serious. I think they're selling that property. Probably building a Starbucks.
Well, I hope not.
I hope not, too.
I hope not. I played a lot of freelance gigs in there when Victoria Bond was in charge of...
Victoria Bond was in charge of a new music ensemble.
She was, and also a wonderful composer.
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm forgetting her name. But anyway, well, say it ain't so, Joe. We'll see about that.
Yeah, I hope so too.
But there's all these groups, and they're wonderful, and
yeah, they are.
It's fun being in new music and old music. Old music's good too.
No, well, just the fact that you are just open, and that you have the ability to sight, not to necessarily sight read, but that you have the ability to perform this music in a way that's economic, and in a way that is practical. Is something that you focused in on when you were young.
Well, you got to learn how to do it. Right. You get experience,
and you had the right teachers. You had the right guys.
Oh, thank you, David. Yes, the right teachers. It helps also if you like it, and I love some of that stuff. I don't love all of it, but I love a lot of it, and so that helps. I mean, if it was such a drag, you just would never do it. You wouldn't want to spend hours and hours fingering a piece of new music if you didn't think it could be wonderful.
Yeah.
So that helps. But it's really, it's very varied. And you're like, I don't know. Would you only want to play early music your whole life? Some people do. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Not you.
I like playing Dowland on a classical guitar and then playing Faya. Right. And then playing some new music.
Yeah, I think
that's the kind. I like going to those concerts. I really do. And it's all classical music.
Yeah.
You know, it's not bebop, it's not free jazz.
Nope, because you're not good at that. That's what you said.
No, I'm not a good jazz player.
All right, Ori. Well, you know what? I'll give you a chance to go home and practice your jazz, all right?
No
more practice.
No.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, Mr. Fader.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, guys. This is John Dowland's Melancholy Galliard. That was what a warm, beautiful person. Right? And next week we have another warm, beautiful person, Mr. Colin Davin, will be joining us. Wish me luck on my recording. I wish everybody luck on the month in September. It's going to be a tough one, guys. So let's stick with it. Again, this is the Melancholy Galliard by John Dowland, performed by none other than Mr. Oren Fader. See you guys next time.